Welcome to another edition of the Spirit Revolution. My name is Philip Cobbins.
My name is Kathleen McGowan.
And today we are going to talk about pyramids. Now, pyramids are primarily known to be in Egypt, and our focus of today is also going to be mostly about Egypt. But let's just say that over the last few years, as I've reported into my book, which came out in 2007 called The New Pyramid Age, pyramids and the pyramid landscape has really transformed since about 1993-1994. Pyramids are no longer just a part of Egypt or Mexico. Pyramids are everywhere. The biggest pyramid is no longer the Great Pyramid of Giza. The tallest one is actually in Bosnia. The one with the widest dimensions is in Cholula in Mexico. And the oldest one is actually in Peru, where the oldest pyramid is archaeologically dated to about 3,200. And there are actually some more pyramids being discovered all the time in Peru who are actually slightly older, but we are waiting there, like the archaeologists, to actually confirm. And it would be about 3,400. So the entire pyramid landscape has been radically changed. And also an understanding as to what pyramids are is slowly evolving. Are pyramids tombs? Well, more and more people are beginning to say they are not. So we, of course, with the Spirit Revolution, are obviously not adhering to the standard lines as well, and so we are going to discuss what our thinking on pyramids is. So, if not a tomb, what could a pyramid be?
Well, you know, first of all, I'm certainly not by any means the first or the last person who will say, if pyramids are tombs, why have we not found any remains in any of these pyramids? Even this most recent television show, Chasing Mummies, where we are chasing Zahi Hawass around Egypt. It's still very clear, despite the focus on mummies, these mummies are not being found, for the most part, in pyramids. They're being found in tombs, they're being found in subterranean chambers and temples, but they are not being found in pyramids. Certainly the Great Pyramid, there have never been remains found in the Great Pyramid, and we know that it was not built as a tomb. It's not a burial chamber. That sarcophagus in the center of the king's chamber is not a burial chamber. It's not big enough. It's certainly not big enough for the gigantic sarcophagi that they would, you know, were putting into these pyramids for pharaohs. So I think the question for me has always been, what was going on in these locations? What was going on in these pyramids? Now, this is a complicated subject because it's not just one question. Each one of these questions, you know, takes you off into another direction. Because I think when you're looking at the pyramids, and specifically the Egyptian pyramids and the Great Pyramid, you're asking yourselves these questions. What were they really? But for me, the question becomes, how old are they really? So I'm going to throw it back at you because you really are. I've spent a lot of time in Egypt. I love Egypt tremendously. I've got some, you know, great personal experience with pyramids. We're going to talk about, you know, my own experience being locked in a pyramid. But you're a real expert on this. You have really, really studied how the pyramids relate to each other, how old they are, how they've been dated. So my question for you is, how old do you think the Great Pyramid is? Do you buy into the current dating of the Great Pyramid that is accepted in Egyptology?
Well, the answer there, I think, is yes and no. Do I believe the Great Pyramid is built in 2600? No. Do I believe it is 20,000 years old? No. The thing I always say about the Great Pyramid is you cannot see it in isolation. You need to see the Great Pyramid definitely within the two other pyramids, which are, right next door to them. So whenever somebody says, like, oh, the Great Pyramid is 10,000 years old and nobody knows how it's been built, it's like the Homer Simpson when he's climbing the mountains in The Simpsons. It's like, you know, and what about the one next door, the Khafre one, whatever you want to use, the Greek or the Egyptian rendering of his name? It's almost just as high, and the reason why it's only slightly smaller is because it's built on a slightly higher elevation, so they wanted to get this beautiful equal height. Now, then when we go away from the Giza Plateau to the shore, you will find the Rat Pyramid. And the Rat Pyramid is somewhat smaller than the Great Pyramid, but has all the same complexity to it. It's got the internal structure, and really the only difference in between the Rat Pyramid and the Great Pyramid is the fact that the King's Chamber is made out of granite and is more elaborate, but anything else construction-wise into building this Red Pyramid, it's really just as complex. So anybody who takes the Great Pyramid into isolation and starts making gigantic theories about it, I will always pull up specifically on those two things, because you need to explain it within that context. You need to, if you take pyramid building out of ancient Egypt and the 2000, 3000 BC time frame, you really need to take quite a few pyramids out there. So then the next question is, we know how the Red Pyramid was made. There are details about the construction written on the outside of the pyramid. Now, you might begin to argue, well, this isn't actually the construction, this is a reconstruction, this is some kind of maintenance which might have had to have happened several thousand years after its building. And that is something which is a possibility, but none of the books or none of the people who have been arguing for this extreme old age have actually taken that into account. And then the last thing is really that in November of 2008, I was invited to go to Dubai to speak at a conference of project managers. And Dubai is really, or definitely at the time before the tremendous economic crisis hit the world, and including the United Arab Emirates, is a place where buildings rise unlike anything else. And anything which is being built, whether it's in America or, you know, South Africa or Europe, takes at least twice as long as is being built right at that moment in time in the Arab Emirates, because all the expertise is there, the project management, the building, everybody is just doing tremendous works, and the tallest building at that moment in time was built there. So I was at a conference where all these project managers of these tremendous building complexes were talking and exchanging notes. And it was so bizarre to see the guy who's building the largest building in the world. And we kind of said, like, what are your problems? And he kind of said, well, as long as we get the mixture consistently right of the cement, we're fine. That's our biggest concern. Everything else is just like, you know, you keep building. But the interesting thing was that I was speaking there about building the Great Pyramid from a project management point of view. And we always say, like, oh, you know, we don't know how this was built. And the interesting aspect is that up until building work started in the United Arab Emirates a few years ago, let's say a decade ago, it was indeed the case that the Great Pyramid represents a tremendous amount of problems for project managers, and specifically for an Egyptologist who has no idea how to build anything, because they're only archaeologists who are able to dig into sand as opposed to other stuff. But for a project manager in Dubai right now, building the Great Pyramid isn't really that complex. And they were actually saying about how, you know, when I was saying, okay, these statistics say that it needs 20,000 people to work on a place like the Great Pyramid, is that something you would ever have done? And they kind of go, yep, that's something we did. We did it for the extension of the runway of Dubai Airport. So every challenge posed, which up until 15 years ago people would have said, actually, no, we have never done that, is something which right now is being done. Now, that does explain the fact that, you know, building the Great Pyramid and all of these pyramids was a tremendous amount of expert knowledge, but we know that at some point, whoever built it, that knowledge was resident within Egypt when they were doing this.
Okay, I have so many challenges for you based on all the things you've just said that I don't even know where to start. I know that many people like me are probably listening to this and thinking, wait a minute, stop. We've got to back up to the Great Pyramid. It raises the hackles on the back of my neck to hear you say that it is not unique, to hear you say that it is not anomalous, because it is. There is nothing else like it. I mean, I hear what you're saying, that there are similarities to the Red Pyramid, but the expression of what the Great Pyramid is completely unique.
And what would you say that that expression is? Because from a construction point of view, the Rat Pyramid, really internal structure, building style, it's almost identical. When I show photographs sometimes of the Rat Pyramid to people, they say, oh, well, it's a photograph of the Great Pyramid. And it's like, no, this is of the Rat Pyramid. So what specifically are you focusing on the Great Pyramid?
There are so many aspects of the Great Pyramid that are completely unique, i.e., first of all, the size. The volume of stone that is used within the Great Pyramid is not equaled by the Red Pyramid or by anything that I am aware of. The geometry of the Great Pyramid, the extraordinary expression of the geometry of the Great Pyramid, the expression of pi within the structure, the fact that it straddles perfectly a parallel, which no other building of ancient or modern times does. There is so much about the Great Pyramid that to me shows that it was completely unique and absolutely singular. When I look at the other pyramids on the plateau, I see lovely but pale imitations. I do not see structures that were created even by the same people at the same time. And part of this is not scientific. Part of this is strictly sentient. When I stand on the plateau and look out towards the pyramids, either from Giza or out in the desert looking backwards, I see an enormous difference. And I feel an enormous difference between how those structures were built and what they were built for.
So what were those structures built for?
Well, I mean, that becomes the question, isn't it? I mean, I am one of those people that believes that the Great Pyramid is significantly older than anyone is saying that it is. And I certainly reject that it was built by Cheops or anybody else in that time period. I think that they may have adopted it. I think that, you know, he might have inscribed his cartouche on it later to claim it, but I don't think he built it. I believe that the Great Pyramid was meant for something much grander than the tomb for any king or any god on earth. I believe that the Great Pyramid was constructed. My personal belief system says that this pyramid was constructed as a type of container for something extraordinarily sacred. I believe that there was sacred knowledge held within that building. I believe that it was a type of ancient library. I believe that that sarcophagus in the middle of the pyramid, in the middle of the king's chamber, actually contained the emerald tablets or some other kind of extraordinarily valuable, if not priceless, artifact or piece of information.
And so when we take the Great Pyramid into isolation, what would you say was the purpose of the other pyramids in Egypt?
I think the rest were built in imitation. And what were they built for? I don't know. You know, I guess one of the questions becomes, how old was this pyramid? And if it really is as ancient as people like, I don't believe 20,000, but I still believe significantly more than we have been told. And, you know, we have that becomes sort of the age-old issue with Egyptologists, isn't it? They don't want it to be older, because if it is older, then we have to sort of rethink everything that we know about ancient Egypt, potentially. I guess my question is, if it is significantly older than the other pyramids on the plateau, did the people who built the additional pyramids in imitation even know what the original one was built for? I mean, how much time is there between the Great Pyramid and the lesser pyramids? I mean, those are questions that I have never been able to answer or see answered in anything. I guess my question for you becomes this. Are any of these pyramids anywhere else that you have investigated, whether it's Bosnia or Peru or Mexico? Are those pyramids tombs? And what were those pyramids built for from your point of view? Because is there some kind of conclusion we can draw by looking multiculturally around the world in terms of what these pyramids are being used for?
Well, I think we need to definitely extract the dating from the tomb theory. I mean, the tomb theory, as you say, holds no water or holds no dead bodies, because there have been intact tombs. For one, the Great Pyramid was an intact tomb, if you want it to be an intact structure, when it was opened, you know, from the 9th century onwards. and the explanation as to why there was no body found inside the Great Pyramid was explained away in something of a bizarre way, which actually doesn't work, that somehow it would have had to have happened to that rock cut passage, which is almost vertical in places leading from the Queen's Chamber down to the subterranean chamber. Other intact pyramids, over 100 pyramids have been found in Egypt. In none of them has there ever been found an intact burial. There were even intact sarcophagi found within pyramids, and when they were opened, there was no body inside. So the theory that the pyramids as a whole, including the Great Pyramid, are tombs is something which Egyptologists like, but there is no hard evidence for it. In fact, when you start looking into the first pyramid which was ever built, according to the traditional timeline, which is the one at Zoser, you will find that the complex in which the pyramid sits was actually constructed for the Hapset festival, which is roughly held every 20 years. And what it is that when a king was crowned as pharaoh of ancient Egypt, roughly 20 years in, but he could do it at any moment in time when he felt like it, he had to assert his power, that he was still in charge, that he still had this vitality to rule. And that festival included certain festivities, but also certain trials. Some of them were public, some of them were private. And those events were called the Hapset Festival. Now, when you look at the inscriptions of the Zoser complex, you will find that this complex was built for this Hapset Festival. And I always compare it to the Olympics. And when you once you link the Hapset Festival with pyramid building, certain things do become clear. And for example, we know that in the Hapset Festival there was a very private ceremony in which certain priests did something to the pharaoh, which was a private ceremony, which occurred out of view from the public, and that this either involved a coffin, a funeral bier, or a chest. And so the need for a sarcophagus or something like a sarcophagus in a secret or secretive place becomes apparent. Also, Snefru, who is Khufu's father, he, according to the traditional timeline, built three pyramids. His first one, the Bent Pyramid, and then the Red Pyramid. Now, my joke is always like, you know, unless this person had a problem with thinking he had more than one body, there was really no need for three pyramids. Egyptologists tried to explain it away as to saying, oh, he changed his mind. Throughout his lifetime, he changed his mind. Well, it just happens that Snefru lived and ruled for about 60 years. So there would have been a need for three Hapset festivals. So if we adhere to this, you know, the comparison to the Olympic Games, and whatever else happened with Egyptian pharaohs, they only used one structure for each Hapset festival. So all of a sudden it becomes, there's a need for Snefru to have three of these complexes, including three pyramids. So that explains some of the ideas. Now, are pyramids elsewhere used as tombs? The answer is yes. There are pyramids which have been used as tombs, but it's not a traditional line. The only thing, if you look at pyramids across the world and have to draw a conclusion, is that it is linked with kingship. That somehow festivities have occur whereby somehow the king doesn't necessarily marry the land, but is saying, I am the ruler of these people, and I am a medium between the world of the deities and the people below me. I am serving them. And those kind of ceremonies normally are linked with a pyramid or a pyramid complex. And on occasion, some of those rulers did end up being buried inside those pyramids. But even when we look for, like, example pyramids in Mexico, where sometimes people like Lord Bacal are buried, you will find that the burial is not the sole purpose of the pyramid into which they were buried. There's always a temple complex, just like there are temple complexes around the Great Pyramid and other temple complexes, other pyramid complexes in Egypt.
Okay, you talk about kingship. What about queenship? Where have you seen, or where could you make an argument for any connection to female rulers and pyramids?
It's an interesting question, and the answer actually I always think is the Great Pyramid itself. Because the question is, okay, if it's not a tomb, what are we left with? And I think, and I didn't check before the broadcast, but I think it's Herodotus, one of the Greek people, the first travelers who goes to Egypt, is on his grand tour. And in Cairo, he's obviously shown the Great Pyramid and the Giza complex. And he gets quite a detailed tour when he's doing this, when the Greeks are ruling. And so you have still got priests in Heliopolis and in Alexandria. You have still Egyptian priests who are talking to Herodotus and explaining these things to him. And one of the things is when he is shown the pyramid complex of Giza, he is shown a house of Isis. And people have difficulty explaining where it was. Egyptologists use subterfuge. Basically, their subterfuge is this. Well, it's not the Great Pyramid because it's so obvious that it didn't need to be explained. So the House of Isis has to be one of the smaller pyramids alongside some of the other pyramids, or even some of the smaller pyramids along the Great Pyramid. But if you take it from like the very first word the guide says and Herodotus starts writing, up until the guided tour is over, the House of Isis can only be one thing, and that is the Great Pyramid. And now, people like Wilhelm Sittmann, who has written about Egypt in books like Egypt, Image of Heaven, and slightly more in the Dutch language. Wim has been a friend of me since 1993. And Wim has always pointed out that one of the more interesting things is when you look at the Great Pyramid and the pyramid next door, and when you look at their internal structure, that the second pyramid represents the male reproductive organs, and that the Great Pyramid represents the female reproductive organs. Now, obviously, in a somewhat stylized format. But when we go into the next step, and with the initiation ceremonies, which you and both of us adhere to, that these were occurring there, and to some extent the Hapset festival, even though it's not an initiation ceremony as such, it's a very powerful religious rebirthing ceremony which is occurring to the pharaoh as such. That this thing is occurring inside something which resembles a female womb. In a man-made cavity, which is a stylized rendition of a natural cave system, is something which is very straightforward, if you want. It's not something which is extreme. It's something which is normal. And so the House of Isis could be the Great Pyramid. Now that doesn't necessarily answer what happened to the female lines. The answer might be, look at the pyramid next door, which is supposed to be in the shape of male reproductive organs. Maybe that is certain things where, some of the female initiation ceremonies occurred.
Well, I was certainly fascinated the first time I ever heard you talk about the possibility of the Great Pyramid being the House of Isis, because I'd never heard it put exactly like that, although I'd certainly heard the connections between the female reproductive system within the internal structure of the Great Pyramid, and I think that certainly takes us to a completely different place than the traditional tomb theory does. And for me, the whole concept of the pyramids being initiation chambers and chambers for the initiated, this is essentially why there are maze structures built within the pyramids, not necessarily to confound grave robbers, but because these are initiation chambers where you are being asked to get out of a pyramid from the inside out as part of your initiation. And for someone who's listening who's just hearing that for the first time, that might sound a little wacky, but let me tell you a story, because this is exactly what has happened to me.
So yes, and that I think is the next level. you know, these were guarded complexes. This the grave robber theory is so bizarre. Clive James once did a trip, and Clive James is an Australian documentary maker. And when he came to Egypt with his TV crew, he said, like, you know, the only thing missing from the Great Pyramids is a neon sign on top saying "Tomb and treasure found below." He said, like, you know, it sticks so out that the fact that this is somehow a deterrent for grave robbers is so out of the ordinary that it just beggars belief. But all of this, yes, certain people are led into Great Pyramids and then are asked to get out. And one of such people is yourself. So what happened when you went to Egypt?
This was my second trip to Egypt in 1997. I was there with my friend Stacy, who I write about in some of my books, who has been my my partner in research for many, many years, since 1995. And Stacy and I were on the Giza Plateau, and we were with a very, very interesting man who is from the indigenous Bedouin cultures in the area, named Farouk. And we had been referred to him through a series of people who knew who we were. And initially, I had no idea going into this what I was getting myself into. I just thought that, you know, Farouk was going to take us to some certain places on the plateau that you can't get to as a tourist. And certainly as we got out into the plateau and all of the men with machine guns looked in the other direction as we walked behind them, I realized that Farouk definitely had some connections and knew what he was doing, because we were pretty much able to go anywhere we wanted to. And he was talking to us and leading us through some things and giving us some information about the plateau and some of the stories that he had been raised on, and took us out to one of the smaller pyramids on the plateau. And we got to the pyramid, and he pointed to a little grate. As you look down at the base of the pyramid, there was a little grate, probably about 3.5 feet wide and high. And it was barred with iron bars, and he pulled a giant key out of his pocket, and he begins to open the grate. And he says, "We're going in." And we kind of hesitated for a minute, because these are the pyramids on the edge of the plateau, which are very dangerous. They're partially collapsing, which is why you're not allowed to go anywhere near them. Tourists aren't allowed in them. He said, "You know, this is something that you have to be able to do for me to be able to tell you any more. You have to do this." And so we followed him. You know, you tend to do you do things in Egypt. I when I look back on my experiences in Egypt, and, you know, riding out into the middle of the desert in the middle of the night with, you know, unknown Bedouins, because I've been told to do so, I sometimes look back and think that I might be crazy. But there's something about Egypt that pushes you beyond your normal limits. There's something about being in Egypt that says, I have to do this. I have to go places beyond my normal 20th century Western comfort zone. And I'm so glad in retrospect that I've done those things. But at the time, they're pretty scary. I mean, they're pretty big jumps for, you know, a sort of traditional middle American to take. So we followed Farouk into the pyramid. And he had a flashlight and he had a candle. And we followed him. He clearly knew exactly where he's going. He had clearly done this many times before. And I'm thinking, as I'm following him, and we're going through the maze-like structure of the pyramid, I'm thinking, pay attention, Kathleen, pay attention, because you're going to have to get out. Because I could feel what was coming. And I thought, okay, I get this. You know, I knew kind of where I was turning, and I'm like, okay, I can do this. And we get to the center of the pyramid, and he hands us the single candle, and he says, okay, give me 10 minutes to get out, and then you have to get out on your own. And I thought, okay, scary, but I can do this. I can do this. It's not, you know, he got us in here. I was paying attention. I think we'll be fine. But I'll tell you something. When you are standing in the middle of a pyramid and all that's around you are granite walls and you have a single candle that is flickering off the granite walls, all of a sudden you have no bearings. You don't have any concept of how you came in. Even though you really think you paid attention, all of a sudden everything looks exactly the same. You don't see the walls anymore the way that you saw them coming in. And it's really, really scary. Now, did I think he was going to leave us in there? No, but I also knew that, you know, getting out was going to be a real challenge for us. And, you know, it's a long story, which I'm going to shorten because we only have an hour on this radio show. But I think it's an important story because this was clearly created as an initiation chamber. Farouk had done this not just with us, but clearly with a lot of other people before us. He had been doing it since he was a child. You know, there is a tradition passed down on the plateau that these are initiation chambers. Now, what for me, my own personal spiritual experience, which was extremely powerful, was as long as you're standing in the center of the pyramid using your sort of everyday walking around waking consciousness, I realized you're not going to get out of there. It's very confusing because we tried and you end up walking in circles and you start to panic. And that's what happens. The rising panic starts to happen. You start to go, ugh, I can't get out of here. You know, what happens now? Everything looks the same. You get that feeling of being trapped. And so this spiritual lesson for me was to let go, was to take myself to another place. At the time, I was studying the mysteries of the Egyptian goddesses. I was specifically studying the mysteries of Sekhmet. And so for me, it was about letting go, and I got into my Egyptian methodology that I had been studying. I asked Sekhmet for help. I went to a different level of consciousness, and I actually allowed Sekhmet to guide us out of that pyramid. And that's exactly what happened. Once I turned myself over to a consciousness that was not my own, something that was higher and that was about trust and about connecting to the divine, we got out of there in about 10 minutes. But it was not until I got out of my own way and learned how to get out of my traditional earthbound humanness and connect to something higher, that I was able to make that jump. And then getting out was easy and seamless. And by the time you actually see that light coming in through the grate of that pyramid, it is so exciting. And you really walk out into the sun a new person. It is an absolute initiation. It changed me, that experience in the pyramid. So you will never convince me that those pyramids are burial chambers. Those pyramids are not for the dead. Those pyramids are for the living.
And it's an interesting standoff once again, isn't it, between the established so-called Egyptologist view, who studies everything and catalogues everything, but at the same time, you have people like your guide, and one of the other people I think both you and I are extremely impressed with is a very similar guy called Hakim, who unfortunately has passed away. But Stephen Mailer interviewed him, and there's a very brief section in, I think, Stephen Mailer's book called The Land of Osiris. Hakim has more airtime in a DVD, which is called The Pyramid Code. But he is another person who lived literally in the shadow of the Great Pyramid. Many of these people have studied Egyptology or have studied something like Egyptology, so they're not just locals with stories to tell and camels to rent out. These are people who are experts and who live there for a specific reason. And they represent the other coin, I think, of the medal, which is you not only have the Egyptology person just cataloging and writing scientific papers, but it is also still an active initiation center run by people and, you know, whom you can contact. You can go there and contact them. And they are of that region. They're not so-called experts, and I won't name names, who come from America or other Western European countries and say, oh, you know, we'll give you powerful experiences in or around the Great Pyramid within 10 days. That is a very westernized point of view. There is an entire living tradition right now which goes back hundreds, if not thousands of years, and, you know, these pyramids are still being used as initiation chambers by people, for people, and you know, this tradition goes on. You know, some of, I believe your expert has since died, Hakim has since died, so they have passed this knowledge on to the next generation, and it's a generational thing. It keeps going, and as we speak, probably somebody on the Giza Plateau, if not in other pyramids in elsewhere in Egypt, is undergoing a transformative moment.
And one of the things I want to say specifically, because people who have been to Egypt and have experienced the sort of the more touristy aspects of it, and I don't mean to denigrate their experience, because even being a tourist in Egypt is an extraordinary thing. Even being a tourist entering the Great Pyramid is an extraordinary thing. But I want to be really clear about something. This was not a backsheesh issue. This was not something that was created to earn money. This cost us virtually nothing. This man was not asking for me to pay him. Did we have to grease a few palms to get in certain places on the plateau? Yeah, but it was nominal. And that was fascinating for me because, as you know, for those who have not been to Egypt, backsheesh is kind of a bribery system, a system wherein you pay people for experiences or to take you or to look in the other direction so you can go someplace you're not supposed to go. But this was not that. This was someone that I had met in Egypt who knew who I was, who wanted really me to have an experience that took me to the next level, recommended us to Farouk, and then Farouk came and gave us this experience, and it was extraordinary. But what I wanted to say is not just that it wasn't about money. It was not about, let's create something that looks this way and then sell it to Western tourists. It was not that at all. And the other thing that I think was phenomenal about it was these guards, and some of these guards out there on the plateau are pretty hardened, and they carry very big guns. They easily looked in the other direction. Now, they were probably, were they all cousins of Farouk on some, you know, level? Possibly. But here's the other thing that I thought was fascinating about it. They know what he's doing, and they let him do it because they know what he's doing. And a lot of those indigenous people, a lot of those people who are multi-generational from the Giza area who are working there are willing to look in the other direction because they do know that there is still layers of the truth and the truth teachings going on. Now, that was 1997, before your friend Zahi really gained a stranglehold on the plateau. And I don't even know if those kinds of things are even possible anymore, given how he has kind of come in and controlled everything. It may not be possible anymore. What do you think?
Yes, that was friend in apostrophes and various other signs. Well, I mean, you know, he was already reigning over the Giza Plateau at that time. It's just that he had lots of layers of archaeology and politicians above him. Since he's become head of the Supreme Council of Antiquities, he only reports into Farik Hosni, who is the Minister of Culture. He only liaises with certain American universities or conglomerates of American universities who guarantee and basically control access not just to the Giza Plateau but pretty much to anything going on in Egypt on an Egyptological point of view. He suppresses an enormous amount of scientific conclusions, and you know, when he kind of goes like, oh, I'm the subject of so many conspiracy theories, the most outlandish things are being withheld, well, some of them he creates himself. He has withheld, for example, carbon dating results from the Great Pyramid, which show that those carbon results say Great Pyramid was built between 3100 and 3400 BC, 800 years roughly older than what is being claimed right now. And he knows that by simply releasing this scientific study, there's nothing wrong with it, everybody in ancient Egypt textbooks will have to go back to square one and kind of like say there's something seriously wrong here, because we are saying, you know, the Egyptologists are saying that in 3100 Egypt was only founded, that, you know, the two kingdoms came together and formed the dynastic rule of Egypt, and then various things happened, and then by the third dynasty pyramid building began, and by the fourth dynasty we have the Great Pyramid. Well, the carbon dating thing just pushes that back with hundreds and hundreds of years, and they have no way of identifying or how to do that, because basically an Egyptologist is largely an archaeologist who can dig. historical research is quite alien to them. So kind of, you know, he's his own worst enemy. But yes, what he's done roughly about a decade ago is when he got his supreme power, is he began to construct a gigantic wall around the Giza Plateau. And this, I think, you know, he will say that it was to make sure that no people came during the night and were starting to climb the Great Pyramid. Well, about a decade ago, that no longer was a problem. He had trained his men sufficiently to kind of like say, look, this is dangerous, you know. You shouldn't allow people to do this. And only in very rare instances, almost like when a very fit person is able to convince a local that he will be able to get to the top without any harm coming to him, would still allow this. You know, the days of when just everybody could pay and try to climb it had gone by then. So I think what he was doing is actually, yes, telling the locals, here's a gigantic wall right behind your building where you live with your family. What's behind this wall is no longer yours. You're no longer to go outside and even sit underneath the stars or whatever you want to do with these pyramids. They are mine and mine only, and I rule supremely over this Giza Plateau. There you have it. And this is a sore term. People, what people don't realize is how much Hawass is hated in Egypt. He is hated by every other archaeologist. People who are the heads of archaeology and or Egyptology departments at Ain Shams University or the University of Cairo hate Hawass because he doesn't have as much archaeological expertise as these have. They know he's held in place by a political alliance, which is just him and Hosni. Hosni is so hated that whenever he visits an archaeological site, he needs to have a bodyguard, sometimes weapon bodyguards, sometimes at gunpoint, to let him get in there. And people kind of like hate Hawass, hate Hosni, try to do everything to get rid of him. But unfortunately, and it's got to be said, it's the American government and an American clique of people who are very much in league with him who let this happen. And this is both for political powers and also for money powers, because it's American universities who bring in the money to do all of these digs. And so what happens is that the American universities, some American universities, not all, bring in the money to Egypt to do this. They get the best deals, and then all the other universities, Germans are normally the second, then the French, get the slightly less digs. But, you know, even German universities at this moment in time can't really get into Giza to dig. And everybody hates this situation, and it boils down to two people in Egypt, to Hawass and to the Minister of Culture. And it's a very, you know, very sad and a very bad situation, because in Egypt, the first victims are the Egyptians themselves. They are no longer able to do some of the things they were doing. And there was an incident last year in September where six people died when they were doing illegal diggings near the Great Pyramid and near that wall. And it's not really known as to why they were digging and what exactly happened. But my suspicion is that what they were actually trying to do was to dig an access tunnel which bypassed the gigantic wall, so that they at night or at whatever moment in time they wanted to did have access to that plateau. But you know that the death of those six people really has never been explained that much. But yes, it's a very dire situation. And once again, for people who listen to the Spirit Revolution on a regular basis, they are confronted with the fact that we quite often see this standoff between indigenous knowledge of, like, you know, go to France and you will see remains of Mary Magdalene on a way which an archaeological textbook will never teach you. Well, exactly the same thing is with Egypt, and whether it is the pyramids or elsewhere in Egypt, you have a living tradition of people who know certain things and who are able to give you life-changing, transformative experiences.
No, absolutely true. And I, you know, this goes back to how we will never understand our history as humans our social history, our spiritual history, as long as we are shackled to textbooks. It is only in going beyond the books that we really learn anything about who we really are, because that's where the truth is. And that's where the truth against the world comes from. The truth against the world comes from this idea that there is so much more than what we are led to believe, what we are taught to believe. You know, back to the Hawass thing, you know, we joke about this show, Chasing Mummies, that's been on the History Channel. It's the train wreck we can't stop watching. I mean, we watch it devotedly every week because we really want to see, what are they feeding us? What is being spoon-fed to us from Zahi? And I think it is an interesting exercise. I think not in the way that the History Channel wanted it to be necessarily. I think what the History Channel has done is that they have shown us how a dictator like Hawass controls everything. This last episode, which was extremely hard to watch for a lot of reasons, showed him in a, quote, conversation with another archaeologist, a woman, and unfortunately I don't remember her name, I wish I did, and talking about a specific dig that she was, you could tell, was incredibly committed to, had spent many, many years of her life and her esteemed career focused on the theories that she was working on to prove through this dig. And Hawass would not listen to her. He just had no interest in her work. And clearly, she had done so much more, so many more years of investigation on this specific dig, this specific issue, and Hawass just dismissed her out of hand as if she were nothing. Now, initially, my thought was, well, part of that is because she's female, and I do believe that to be true, but I think he just dismisses everyone who has a theory that is not his. But it was such a clean-cut example of how this woman's diligence and commitment to getting to the truth and her excitement about, but what if we can prove this? What if we find this? What if, you know, I mean, she had such passion for what she was trying to prove, and what she was trying to prove was something about Cleopatra and where Cleopatra was actually buried. Really exciting stuff. And Zahi absolutely would not hear it. But watching it captured on camera that way for me was very powerful. And I hope it was as powerful for other people. I hope other people were looking at it in the same way I was, which was to say, wow, this is exactly how history is created, manufactured right here. Because what you saw in that scene was history will be exactly the way Zahi Hawass determines it's going to be and nothing else. And it was sad to the point of tragic for me, but also incredibly important. So that's why I say this Chasing Mummies series is becoming an important aspect of understanding history, but definitely not in the way the History Channel originally created it for.
Yes, and I mean, when you look at the way Hawass has always been able to portray himself, it's very much in control. It's you know, like, okay, we need a 30-second soundbite. You have a brush in your hand, and you're doing away either dust or sand from this or that, and he's giving his expert opinion. But this is a show which follows him. And this calm and cool and collected image which he's able to give on so many shows, that just drops on this show because he cannot contain that for 24 hours a day. You know, Hawass is unable to control his rage for more than 30 minutes. And because this show is about multiple cameras constantly in his face, you get to see how he sometimes loses his big time. And yes, he's extremely denigrating to women, but he's also extremely denigrating to men. And I think the only difference in the way he approaches women, sort of the way he brushes off women and their theories, he treats them as like silly girls or something. Whereas with men, he shouts at them frontal in their face and calls them idiot, with his finger pointing at, you know, an inch from your nose. So it's only in the manner in which he brushes off other people that I think does he distinguish from anybody. He's not interested in hearing anyone's opinion. And in this case, what was so sad is that this woman knows what she's talking about. This woman has got an extremely elaborate, intricate theory, which is probably true. But he says, no, my belief is that Cleopatra is buried into the East Harbor, and kind of like, you know, that's what it is. Anywhere else is not good. And you can almost see what's going to happen is that at some point this woman will leave Ptah Osiris, dig site near Alexandria, go somewhere else, and in 10 years, if he's still around, he will claim the discovery of Cleopatra's tomb precisely where she has said it was and pretend it was his. You know, Hawass does do hardly any digs. Hawass's position is administrative. Yet, for anybody thinking or watching the History Channel or all of these things, you would think that he's constantly digging and doing things and that there's only one Egyptologist in Egypt. That's simply not true.
No, but it certainly does make it look that way. It certainly makes it look like the only person who's doing any work is Zahi Hawass. And by the way, I watch the show just so I can hear you do your Zahi Hawass impersonation, which has become one of my favorite things.
Well, thank you very much. Slightly going back to the Great Pyramid, where does this leave us? Do we think that, you know, where does it go from here? Because these people, this... the Hakims have been given some voice on the pyramid code. On occasion, you know, the Egyptologists or writers about Egypt do take them into account. But it's rare for me to see, at this moment in time, this indigenous voice from the Arab world rising out and saying, like the Mayans have done on you know, so many occasions, the Mayan shaman have said, we are this tradition, we do not really like what archaeologists are saying about these pyramids or about these temples in Mexico. We have an indigenous tradition. It's interesting, I find, that the Mayan world got to this point very fast. You know, 20 years ago, they were massacred. 20 to 30 years, they were massacred. Now they're everywhere. And you can go to the Mayans and kind of have a completely indigenous Mayan experience of saying, this is what we do here, and this is how it works. I don't see any tour advertised like that for Egypt. And I don't see an Arab movement of people like Hakim and your guide standing out and saying, come and talk to us. And I don't really know whether that is because it is a secretive society that they want you to find them rather than advertise themselves all over the internet, or whether it is because they are a suppressed minority and Zahi Hawass and or the Arab culture kind of like suppresses them. I don't know. What do you have ideas or opinions on this?
I think it's a combination of both of those things. I think that there is a secrecy to it. I do think that you had to be recommended in order to have these experiences. It wasn't, again, these were not people, you know, standing on the plateau with a camel saying, give us $20 and we'll take you out into the desert. I mean, this was a very, very different kind of experience. So there was a sort of a secrecy about the recommendations for it. I think part of it was also because it's dangerous. They don't want everyone out there because the last thing that they need are dead tourists who are trapped in pyramids or injured tourists who are trapped in pyramids. But I do think that there's a cultural element in Egypt that you do not find necessarily in the Latin American cultures. I think that because of some of the political and religious issues that Egypt is up against, I think that by definition, this concept of the ancient tradition has had to be secret. I think that for some of these indigenous cultures, you know, there's also been an interesting juggling for them in terms of where they are as Muslims versus where they are as people who come from a different pharaonic tradition. And I think that all of those things have been kind of tricky for them to balance. So I think that there's a sensitivity to the people in Giza that there is not anywhere else in the world. And unfortunately, I think that sensitivity has made it so much easier to completely suppress the ancient traditions, and it's made it easier for people like Zahi Hawass, who want to put a lid on all those things, to do so. And, you know, as long as he lords it over, you know, over the plateau, and now he's the, you know, the supreme ruler of these things, unfortunately, I think that the only thing we're going to see is these traditions going further and further underground. You said earlier, and I hope that you're right, that the Hakims and the Farouks of the world hopefully left these these stories, these rituals, these traditions, this beautiful richness that they were raised with, that hopefully they pass them on to the next generation. I hope so. I don't know that that's true. I haven't seen any young people sort of celebrating this, and I would certainly love to see that, you know, a youth revolution amongst the Egyptian people, talking about, you know, these ancient traditions. I certainly hope that that's the case, because to lose these traditions, to see them die out, would be a terrible, terrible thing for the human race, a terrible loss.
Yes, indeed, because you know, the Great Pyramid is the only surviving wonder of the ancient world. It's, as we've been saying, it's something which continues to enthrall people. It's something which is there. And just going to Egypt and standing in front of the Great Pyramid and touching it is such an enormous experience, because it is a gigantic monument. It is, you know, a wonderful thing. And to realize that this was, you know, an operating system. And people, up until like the 4th, 5th century, there are records of people who were initiated there, who were able to write it down. And the Arab world, to some extent, kind of, you know, pushed these people into oblivion as well, pushed them underground more than they were, because they live, you know, on a very important city called Cairo. If the pyramids were somewhere in the middle of the desert, I think they would have a little more freedom than living on the edge of a gigantic town or city as Cairo. So the Great Pyramids stand there, and they will continue standing there for much longer than this show, because this show is coming to an end. So from Kathleen and I, until next time, if you want to listen to this again, or if you are listening on the archive, the archives are everywhere. They are on bbsradio.com. We are our own website, thespiritrevolution.com, and you can also download us from iTunes. So until next time,
the truth against the world.